Hello there, I'm Hayley Stevens and this is The Spooktator, a podcast which examines the stranger elements of life, society, international culture and the media. I'm joined by Charlie Revel-Smith and Paul Gannon.
Hello everyone. Hello.
This episode will ask what weird delights and horrors we predict we'll come to see in the headlines throughout the new year. But first, I just want to thank all of our listeners for their patience in waiting for this episode. It's been a little while coming. Last October, I was rushed to hospital with some serious health issues after what should have been a routine visit to my optician. I'm well on the road to recovery and I'm feeling much better, but for a number of months, it was just impossible for me to produce the podcast. We've been really heartened with all the social media messages and emails asking when we're going to put the next episode out. You've all been so patient, well done, and we appreciate it. And the good news is that we are back. Silence.
Oh, sorry. Hooray!
Yay! Yay! Insert fireworks Woo-hoo! Explosion special effect.
Now, Charlie, Paul, what have you guys been up to since we last spoke?
Well, since we last spoke, which was actually, I think the last one was the one just before Halloween, wasn't it? I've subsequently written, finished, published my Weird Bristol book, which sold very nicely over Christmas. And I'm soon going to be working on the follow-up, More Weird Bristol. And today I had my first driving lesson as well, which was something I've been meaning to do for quite some time, but finally got round to it at the age of 37.
Is it one of your New Year's resolutions?
It was sort of kind of New Year's resolution, but like a couple of years back. And it's been sort of like the thing which I've been kicking down the road repeatedly. And eventually I've just got to like the point. It's like, come on, just give it a go. And it's a little bit alarming, but it's not as scary as I thought it was going to be. We sort of just driving very, very slowly around a public park in the rain actually proved to be not as difficult as I imagined it was going to be. But this is the very, very first lesson, so we'll see how it goes.
And also, Bristol's plenty weird, so you'll be writing books about the place for years, right?
Absolutely, yes. Oh, no, no, I've got... There is in my mind, I've got more than just More Weird Bristol. There is a... There was
even more weird.
Yes,
Bristol.
Yes. No, this could run and run and run. As long as I can keep unearthing strange things, then the books will keep coming.
I've got taking driving lessons on my New Year's resolution list, which I wrote when I was sort of tipsy. Because there's also have a perm on there, and I have no intentions of getting my hair permed. But for some reason, I guess on that day, I just thought, hey, I should get a perm. So we'll see how that pans out.
I think you should be legally lessons. Bound to keep New Year's resolutions. So I'm really? Sorry, it means you have to get a perm, I'm afraid.
It also says to get my nose pierced, and I don't think that's going to happen.
No,
so
I'm
arrest me.
That them's the law.
Yeah.
It's got to be that.
Also, not 1994 anymore, right. So you don't need to get your nose pierced.
Oh, whatever. You can get your nose pierced whenever you want. Sod it. I'm going to get my nose pierced.
No, is that you. Anti-peer pressure? Is that like... is that...
Yeah. What about you, Paul?
Oh, me. Cheap Show's going well. We're just about to cross 1 million downloads, funnily enough,
wow.
For that bloody podcast.
Very
Digitizer,
impressive.
The retro comedy video game show where Mr. Biffo ran on YouTube. 6 episodes up there. You can enjoy that. That was busy working for BBC London over Christmas, so I skipped Christmas. And now I'm here.
Yay.
That's pretty much it in a nutshell. Yay. But I was thinking, oh, what would make me feel nice? What would be a nice warm welcome to 2019? And it suddenly dawned on me.
Oh,
Most Haunted's back. So
okay. That went in
a
completely different direction than I thought it was going to go. And I was like, oh,
yeah,
musical.
Well, no. I'm no. Subversive. I'm an edgelord. You should know that by now. So, I watched. Well, I'll be honest. I only watched half of the first episode back of season 9 for one good reason. It's 2 hours bloody long. And
really?
I thought, it's meant to be an hour, isn't it? Because episode 1 is, they've called it As Live Eden Camp Museum Part 1. So that suggests to me there's 4 hours of this bloody investigation to sit through.
Oh, good Lord.
And what does As Live mean? Because when they filmed
it... I know this one. I used to work at a venue and we would do National Theatre as live and Royal Opera House as live, and it means that it was recorded when it happened live, but then played back at a different date.
So they say as live, and to say, like, imagine this is a live broadcast right now, but it's not, because there's going to be an odd edit here or there, or we can go to ad breaks.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's kind of like having a real-time version of Most Haunted, then.
Yeah, like a Most Haunted live.
So. Yeah, kind of like that.
It's sort of like a recording of Most Haunted without any edits, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Which can only make it less interesting.
Well, I mean, they come straight out of the gate with some interesting stuff, I will say this. Let's just be honest. I'm not going to go into the details of what happened, because it's Most Haunted. They whistled, things are thrown, they heard footsteps, Yvette has a panic attack. That's Most Haunted every week, all right, in a nutshell. But what was interesting is the little amendments they've made to the show. So they've added a new member. Her name is Mary. And it's basically like they've rebooted Yvette Fielding. And so Mary kind of comes across as like Yvette Light to hang around with Darren, because guess what they've removed from this series, apparently, or certainly the first few episodes? No Fred Bat.
Ooh.
And there's a wonderful little moment in that first episode where, who's his name? Darren on sound, the guy who looks like a petrified Shaggy from Scooby-Doo.
I genuinely don't know, Paul, because I don't watch it.
Oh, well, you're missing out. Anyway, Darren basically says he likes working with Mary now because Fred upset him and it was doing his head in. And so I'm wondering.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. And does he actually say that in the show?
Yes. And then he goes, I'm glad it's Mary, because if she started trying to incant the devil, I end up having to throttle her.
What?
Basically suggesting that if she was doing something Fred would do, he'd throttle Fred as well because he's tired of it.
Ah. Okay.
So very strange. So Mary is in the show and she sounds like Yvette, looks a little bit like Yvette, but with dark hair rather than blonde, has the same, like, is it Lancashire accent, Manchester accent, whatever it is.
It's not Lancashire.
Shouts at ghosts like a school teacher. It's all there. It's just now it's farmed out. And then they had two ladies called Lou and Jenny, and they were in the ops room centre, where it just meant they had live feeds to four CCTV cameras, and they thought that made them like traffic control people. they get scared quite a lot. A door swings open. They capture it on camera. It looks impressive when you see it, but ultimately you don't see the very top or the very bottom of the door with the way they framed it. So,
That's stupid. You know.
Yeah.
But what?
So no evidence.
No, I mean, don't forget about it. And it's like they're obviously trying to give themselves something to do because they've just been told to sit there and look at other cameras all night.
That's what I used to do when I went ghost hunting. We would set up like cameras, and then we'd have a HQ, and we'd sit in the HQ watching all the different cameras and telling the other people what to do. It was brilliant.
Well, they've definitely got rid of like any psychic element now, and well, hopefully that would be great if they got rid of that completely and all the demonology rubbish. Uh-huh. So that's gone. And I don't know. It's just, it's the same thing. There's a little moment where they go, right, we're going to try and break up into smaller groups and do different types of experiments in different rooms. And, okay. And then she radios over to Carl and Stuart. Now, you know, we've agreed this series. We're not going to look for any negativity. We're not going to look for bad things. Is that all right? And Carl goes, yeah, hangs up. Throw a knife at me. Come on. Throw a knife at me. Almost instantly from that.
Why are they always so angry with the ghosts? That's what I've never understood.
It's because they're men, Charlie.
They just seem to like Yvette has a go at them occasionally. They like genuinely get angry at these ghosts for not showing up.
Do you think it's because they, I don't know, I mean, when I see other ghost investigators who do that, and you know, the ones who go out into the middle of the woods looking for black-eyed kids and stuff, they always see it almost feels as though they're trying to prove themselves something about, you know, they're trying to prove something about themselves more than necessarily about the paranormal by showing how brave they are.
Yeah, I just think this whole idea of being
to aspire to,
like, being combative against the supernatural just seems kind of arrogant. It's like, come on, I'll take you all on. It's like being drunk outside a pub at 3 a.m. it's that same behavior.
I think it's fine if you want to be, well, it's just twattish. But if you want to kind of be combative with a ghost, that's fine. But then don't scream if something then gets thrown at you.
But
I
will end on two quick points. One is the ghosts of this, you know, army camp, now museum, had German soldiers in, and they were apparently, you know, looked after quite well and, you know, lovely. But Yvette at some point, speaking to these German ghosts with tapping and the usual bollocks, goes, can we help you get out of here? And I'm thinking, you can't help the enemy escape, Yvette.
Traitor.
He's fraternising with the enemy, trying to get them to escape.
But I think my favourite thing of the whole episode is when, like, you know when you see a horror film and like they're walking down a corridor, and then out of nowhere, a cat jumps out and it's a cheap jump scare. Yeah. They had their own cat moments because there's a cat that lives at the museum and it's following them around the whole night. And there's so many beautiful moments where, like, you hear the door go, ee! Oh my God, what is that? Oh, it's the cat. And the cat's meowing in the background and they're trying to chase it away. So that was it in a nutshell. Same old, but I think they're trying to push away from you know, the psychic and demonology stuff. And I think they're trying to get just back down to the whole cameras and evidence and sound recording and EVPs and K2s like they used to in the olden days.
Having a 2-hour long episode is not going to help there, because the first series,
yeah,
they were half an hour episodes, weren't they? So there was sort of punchy and short.
Get in,
and
get out.
Yes, it just felt like, because the time was so compressed, it actually probably felt like more stuff was actually happening than actually did.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it just makes it more boring the longer that you spread it all out. I mean, of the really early ones, I always think of the Red Lion Inn in Avebury as just being a brilliant piece of television of her, Yvette, in the room by herself with the camera locked off on her face and seeing what I do believe genuine fear and her attempting to overcome her own fear in that supposed haunted room. And it was really intense television. And nothing like that has happened in well over a decade on that show. And it just soldiers on regardless.
Yeah.
I've heard rumours, Paul.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Or does it soldier on regardless?
Yeah, I've heard rumours that this year might see Most Haunted coming to an end. Do you know if that's true?
I don't, because when I tried to do the research of this, basically it came from a tweet from, I don't know how official this account is, but like Watson the dog is a character on Most Haunted. There's a Watson the dog thing. But in the past, its tweets have kind of suggested that it knows a little bit about, you know, the production of Most Haunted. I don't know why.
So it's coming from within.
So Watson the dog posted a tweet saying, "Sees the final season of Most Haunted, blah, blah, blah." And then someone went, oh, no, not really. And he went, yeah, viewing figures weren't great, which, you know, we're not going to wade into the viewing figures bollocks again. I'm telling you that for a fact. But the thing is that, let's just say this is the final season. They're prepping it to be like, but the next generation's coming. Because like when they introduce Mary to the show, they're like saying, she's the next generation of Most Haunted crew members and she's going to bring a young vitality to the show and, you know, she's going to be this, that and the other. And I was thinking, weird phrase, isn't it? And then bringing two dinner ladies in to do the ops room centre and they're just sitting there getting carried away.
Can I ask, Mary, it's not Yvette Fielding's daughter, is it?
No,
isn't her...
I don't know. Is Mary Yvette's daughter?
Yeah, I think she named her son William and her daughter Mary.
Oh, well, then maybe.
Sure, after ghosts.
Because that would explain why they, you know, look and sound similar.
Yeah, when you said that, I was like, pretty sure that's her daughter.
Well, then maybe it is then. Well, here's the thing. I don't know what the budget for Most Haunted is by and large. I can't imagine it's much, but it's probably enough that, you know, it's not like easy to just knock out a couple off their own back. But I do wondering if they moved their show to YouTube, how much more successful they might be.
It's quite a point, yes. That's, or even Amazon Prime or something like that.
Yeah, because Amazon Prime,
if they already have their own production company, which I believe they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then they're, you know, they can sort of move it around to anywhere that they want to and just sell it to distributors like that.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what they're thinking, that things might be wrapping up on, is it really the channel?
No, it's UK Living. No.
Okay.
Oh, I don't know. It might be really. I don't know. It's all
stupid
names.
People just like stuff on demand now, don't they? So maybe they are making a move towards something like that.
Well, I mean, they've obviously got something planned. They're still allegedly trying to put the movie together.
The movie, yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I'm still kind of keen to see what that's like. But also, I just think maybe financially it might be good if they did a Patreon and YouTube and kept the swearing off and uploaded it in ad breaks. They could make money on YouTube doing it, maybe.
Yep.
They could have a Patreon level where you, if you pledge a certain amount each month, you get to choose which one of the which one of Carl or Stuart launched themselves down a staircase or into a fireplace or out of a window.
It's a shame you can't have them both.
Maybe that's the way the vote would go each month.
Maybe.
Yeah, it's a deadlock 50-50.
Yeah, out you both go. One vote for each. Now that 2019 is here, I wondered if you guys have any predictions for the sorts of spooky and paranormal things we might expect to see in the headlines as the year progresses. I think sometimes it's interesting to see what people start talking about around this time that might continue to be the hot topics as the year carries on. If you're listening to this and something comes to mind, maybe you've seen people talking about, I don't know, Frogman. I suspect there is actually a Frogman out there. I was just trying to think of one off the top of my head, but let's face it, there probably is a Frogman. We'd love
his name's Michael Gove, am I right? Yeah.
Oh god, politics. We'd love for you to tweet us at Spooktator or leave a post on our Facebook page telling us what you think we might see making the headlines throughout 2019. What about you guys? Do you have any predictions about what might make the headlines?
Well, this is not based on any evidence whatsoever, but I am thinking that 2019 is going to be the year of the rise of the cryptids. I think it's been a few years since we actually, cryptids had their time in the sun. So I think we're going to see, yes. Bigfoot's always around. Loch Ness Monster pops up all the time, but I want to see some more unusual things. I want to see some more chupacabras. I want to see some. I want to see more Gower down in Cornwall.
Owlman
back again. Mothman had a bit of a year last year, but I would like to see more from him. I'm thinking just generally, I want some nice, good old fashioned cryptids. I want to, even if we go down to big cats roaming the English countryside, I want to see.
Oh, they're always in the news, Charlie.
Yeah, so but my prediction is going to be that this year they are going to make a big comeback because I feel like they haven't really had their own year. At least the lesser known ones, the ones we don't hear about too often.
Okay.
Champlain, all of those kind of ones. I want them to rise up and claim 2019 as their own.
Question. Leprechauns aren't cryptids, are they? No, they're elves.
Kind of fey, elves, all that kind of thing, I think.
Goblin folk.
Though I'm sure there's someone out there who will be emailing us to say that we got that wrong. Actually, so if anyone does know what a leprechaun is, let us know. I think it's a fairy. It kind of falls under the umbrella of fairies.
Elf,
like
goblin, gnome, all of those sort of little people.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that you hope to see some more cryptids because already this year there's a very rare cryptid that has made the headlines already, and that is the Tasmanian tiger.
Which
you don't really hear much about. I mean, maybe you do and we're just really ignorant, but I also want to see some of the more less common cryptids in the headlines. What's really interesting about this sighting of the tiger, which is also known as the Thylacine, is that it comes with a photograph, and it's quite a good photo in that you can actually see the creature.
It looks like a thylacine. There is a taxidermied one in Bristol Museum. And as soon as I saw the picture, I was like, oh, that looks like, without any description of what it's meant to be, that looks like the thylacine.
So was that taken in New Zealand?
It was taken by a guy called Peter Groves, and he was walking along a trail in the coastal town of Clifton Springs in Australia. Oh. And he says that he's seen it before. And this is the Tasmanian tiger, for those who don't know, is extinct. But there are many who don't believe that it is. People say that they see it. And believe that it's still out there in small numbers. And he was walking along this trail in this coastal town and saw the creature up ahead of him. It didn't seem to be at all bothered by his presence. And he says that he stood there for a good 5 minutes or so with it kind of looking at him and him watching it. And then he thought, oh, maybe I should take a photograph of this, which, yeah, good idea, dude. Very good idea. So he took the photograph, and despite it being somewhat blurry, he thinks that it shows a number of interesting features. So he says it has the trademark stiff tail of the phylocene, and he also says that it could just be a mangy fox, but doesn't think it is because the animal looked bigger than a fox. But to me, I mean, I looked at the photograph and I saw the tail and I was like, yeah, I can see what he means. But then the more that I looked at the photograph, the more I thought that actually maybe it could just be a large fox with mange.
I thought it was a dog.
There is also that it could just be a dog. In fact, it doesn't look entirely dissimilar to my dog, Reggie. It's the same sort of colouring and sort of facial features, I would guess. I would say down the list, thylacine is probably quite far down. I mean, I know that dingoes are generally kind of like a bit bulkier, but domestic dogs come in all shapes and sizes, and the tail in the picture does look unusually straight and like a rod.
I thought it could be part of the bush.
At the picture, it's not necessarily the tail, is it? The tail could quite easily be between its legs, and that's actually the bush behind it.
Yeah, I think there's kind of the suggestion that that is the tail, and then once you're told that it's the tail, you see it as the tail. It could easily just be that there seem to be some branches. It could just easily be a branch sticking up that happens to overlap the back. It does look a bit like a dog. I thought it had quite like the long kind of snout of a fox. And when it comes to the size, we don't really have anything there that we as observers can measure it against to work out how big it actually is. And as we know with a lot of big cat sightings here in the UK, people tend to overestimate the size of what they saw.
Yeah, and it's so difficult estimating sizes of animals, especially from a distance.
Absolutely.
That almost unless you've got a person standing next to it, you've got no hope at all. It was just a couple of episodes back we had, was it a supposed lion in Birmingham?
In Birmingham,
From a picture. And yeah, it did initially look like it could be. And then once you sort of got an idea of size, it was like, well, it could actually just be a domestic cat or a dog.
Paul, do you have any predictions about what we might see in the headlines?
So I think we mentioned it last year, but I can't remember. But you remember Dear David, the Twitter thing?
Good one.
It's being made into a movie.
What?
Yes.
So look forward to that. So I think that's going to be this year or end of or beginning of next. But I think that's a given, right? I think what I'm going to predict is that between now and then, those ghost stories are going to ramp up a little bit while he starts drumming up interest for the movie.
Okay.
Because it's been quiet lately. And also, I hate Dear David. I think it's the worst ghost story I've ever heard.
It's going to make a crummy, crummy movie. This is not going to be at the level of Hereditary or something like this.
It'll be Slender Man.
Slender Man, Truth or Dare, all of those kinds of like third-rate horror movies that came out last year. That's the kind of level it's going to be. Or The Nun, you know, all of those kinds of those kind of crappy PG-13 or 12-rated horror films.
I think what will happen is that Twitter account will ramp up, or it will close the story off, because I think at some point there'll be a script meeting where it'll be like, can you wrap this up? Can you, like, I don't know, do an exorcism? And
that would absolutely happen, because otherwise it's too much of a loose cannon for the production company.
Maybe he'll just
going to have to go on his whims. Yeah, I bet that's what happens. He will vanish, or at least the account will vanish, and then This Morning rounds before the film comes out.
No, I was thinking more like he'll just suddenly vanish, and the idea will be that the baby Dear David thing has killed him. Because that's what I would do.
Oh, I think he wants to get a career off the back of this, though. I'm not sure if he would actually want to vanish off the face of the planet. But But okay, that's my prediction. That's my prediction. He won't vanish.
Okay.
So that's what I think then. I just think there's going to be a ramp up of activity.
Okay. Well, one thing to keep in mind is that sometimes the same old stories make the headlines regardless of what year it is. One story which keeps popping up on a regular basis is the Rendlesham Forest UFO case. Now, for anyone who's not familiar with this story, Rendlesham is considered the UK's best known UFO legend. And nearly 40 years ago, it involved a number of US military personnel based in RAF Woodridge in Suffolk, witnessing what they believed to be UFOs over a 2-day period. Ian Ridpath, who was the first journalist to become involved in the reports coming out of the area about the strange lights in the sky, concludes that the UFOs were actually a misinterpretation of a series of nocturnal lights. In the first few days of 2019, you may have read these stories, the Rendlesham case was once again thrust into the news when many tabloids reported that the entire thing could have been a prank because somebody had come forward to admit that they had indeed carried out the hoax on the airmen. And this is a revelation that proved to be absolutely explosive and provoked a huge reaction from many people involved in UFOlogy or ufology, which, for those not down with the lingo, are people who research UFO phenomena and sightings. Tabloids like The Sun reported that the hoax had come to light all these years later after an SAS insider contacted a British ufologist with the truth. That ufologist was actually Dr. David Clark, a respected author and professor of journalism at Sheffield Hallam University. On his website, Clark writes, and I quote, "Some time ago, a person who claims to be an SAS insider wrote to me after he saw me talking about Rendlesham on a TV doc. I'll call him Frank. His motive, it was about time the truth was revealed about the incident." Now, Clark investigated the claims that this Frank made in some detail. You can find all the details at drdavidclark.co.uk, and we'll pop a link in the show notes at spooktator.co.uk. So in his research, Dr. David Clark contacted Robin Horsfall, who was a former SAS sniper. And people may be familiar with Horsfall because he took part in the famous Special Forces operation that stormed the Iranian embassy. And that happened just 6 months before the alleged prank in Rendlesham. And Horsfall told Clark the letter writer is someone dangling a fishing rod, and said to Clark that the language used provides no evidence of a military background. He told Dr. Clark, and I quote, "We did undertake planned training actions against British military establishments, but never against those of the US forces. Working against the US units with live ammunition without strict safety protocols could have got people killed with huge political ramifications. The idea of a revenge prank by the SAS isn't plausible, as the rules controlling pyrotechnical devices within the regiment were very strict, and any such action could have resulted in those being involved being returned to units." And so once David Clark realised that it was unlikely to have been a hoax, he sat on the information to see if this guy would contact anybody else. And lo and behold, the media picked the story up and they ran with it. And unfortunately, not all of the tabloids reported the story correctly, and many wrote of the hoax claim in a way that suggested Dr. Clark thought it was a potential explanation, which has led to some real vitriol from some well-known figures in the ufology world. And I expect that a lot of our listeners probably believe now that Rendlesham is a hoax, when that just simply isn't the case.
I had seen bits and pieces of this, and I've always found Rendlesham absolutely fascinating, not just because of the claims that were made, but because when you actually look at the initial reports and the initial stories of the night, it was not a dramatic story at all, really, and really could be explained by things like the lighthouse at Woodbridge. Their recording of the sounds matches up precisely with the motion of the lighthouse. It was years later that it began getting elaborated on, in a lot of the same way that Roswell did as well. Yeah. all additional stories started coming out a long time after the initial the first reports. And I think that this is just another one of them, that this is just another piece that's been added to the story. And who would have thought it? The tabloid press reported it incorrectly.
No, oh, but it's juicy because I've just been doing a bit of research and two lovely things popped up. One was the official forestry, you know, the government department of forestry in this country had a website that gives you a nice UFO tour of Rendlesham. It says where you can go and how you can and look after the forest on your trip. And it does a little nice family day out, look for UFOs. That's lovely. The second thing is, I don't know if you knew this. This was reported 8th of November last year, but a Hollywood legend, Lawrence yes. Fishburne, is to star in a TV show about Rendlesham. It'll be an 8-part supernatural paranormal series called Rendlesham.
Yes.
And directed by Joe Ahern, who was responsible for quite a few Doctor Who episodes.
Yes, so Rendlesham is one of those stories that doesn't stop giving, and so I think we'll probably see that in the headlines this year more and more. I think ufology as a whole will probably pick up and become a lot more popular this year, especially when you consider that as 2018 became 2019, we had several cases of, well, there were two incidents, one at Gatwick Airport and one at Heathrow, where people reported seeing drones in the sky. Heathrow was shut down temporarily and Gatwick was shut down over a number of days, I think it was, in response to these drone sightings.
Over 36 hours, there was no flights.
That's
at all,
right. I believe. And with the Gatwick one, that was interesting in particular because there were around 70 sightings of drones in the area, but there was never any proof that there had been drones sighted. And I think, personally, I think it's probably one of those things where once somebody suggests that there's drones in the area, you see a bird and you think drone.
Yes. Suddenly every seagull is a drone.
Yeah. So I think we might see.
I think there could well have been, with the Gatwick one at least, there could possibly have been an initial drone.
Yeah, maybe.
But then after that, then it's just people's imaginations getting the better of them. And also, there are a certain number of people who just like being part of the news.
Yeah.
Making up
crap. But then this is the problem when you had that couple that were named as the drone flyers and they were slapped all over the papers before they even had due process.
Yeah.
And quite rightly, they were pissed off about the whole situation.
Oh, yeah, they should rightly be furious.
It was really shocking that I thought that was, it kind of revealed the mentality behind a lot of the tabloid papers in the rush to release a story rather than taking a measured approach to it.
Yeah. Who would have thought it? But then this is what happens when you have rolling news. Yeah. You know, there can't not be news.
Have to
now.
Fill the papers.
That's the problem.
And the actual news is in competition with other news sources, which is never a way of getting at the truth.
And
not that I'm saying that we should have a state run media or anything. But there are problems when you actually have a bunch of tabloids trying to compete with each other for the juiciest story.
Yeah.
Journalistic ethics go to the wayside.
But as a behind the curtains kind of thing with BBC radio, it's like I'm only in a small part of it, but I have access to all the news feeds that we get, so we know what's coming in, so the news readers can form their own news reports. And it's not so much what the news reports are, it's the quantity of them that come in. Every few minutes they're updating with news stories from around the world, and I'd just be like, it's a miasma of just stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
How do you pick out what are the relevant...
And fact check it.
Bits.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And when the drone thing happened, it happened when I was working overnight, and obviously, funnily enough, there were reports about New Year's Eve, and there were reports, little reports that didn't go anywhere, but so much of it was coming in that you go, well, who picks up that? Like a knife crime statistic comes in, but there's no knife attack. Oh, give it a day, you'll get one. And so it's like you get these people who are like banking news stories and facts so they can make relevancy to other stories that might come up tomorrow. Or it's strange. It's just like they just have to go and field so much information and just to draw out what's worth doing at the top of the hour.
And people do like patterns in their news as well. So if there is like a high profile, say a dog attacks a child, then in the following days there will be every kid who gets bitten by a dog, even if it's really minor, suddenly gets reported. Yeah. And people suddenly start thinking there is a weird pattern. Why are the dogs suddenly behaving really strangely? It's like, well, it's actually not. It's just the way that news sort of runs on themes occasionally. And this week, where our theme is dogs biting children.
It's more like a fad. It's more like news are like fads. Yeah.
You see it a lot with paranormal stories when somebody who's seen a ghost, or maybe they've taken a ghost photo or a video or anything like that, when they make the media, what you'll also find happens is you'll have the story about what's happened to them or what they're saying. And then at like halfway down the article will be a rundown of maybe like half a dozen more recent ghost stories. So you get like this kind of build up of recent ghost stories that just continually get retold.
Well, it's interesting, just to go off on a tangent, actually, is that the woman who married the ghost got a divorce.
Yeah, Amanda Sparrow. Oh.
Yeah.
I thought those guys were going to make it.
She married Jack Teague, the long dead.
But didn't... I don't want... Obviously, this is a bit like conjecture because I can't state my facts and where I said them. But I'm pretty sure I read somewhere on Facebook or on a forum that... doesn't she work for a PR company or something?
I was she's involved told with this.
Like setting up a...
Yeah. I've read that somewhere. I did the worst ghost of 2018 on my blog, and she...
Oh, that's probably where I read it then, fair enough.
Well, no, because I didn't include it there, but I included her story of her divorce and how she just happens to be a Jack Sparrow impersonator who married Jack Teague, and which is, in the Disney films, was Jack Sparrow's father's name. Yeah, and then someone told me that she worked for a PR company after I published that. So, yeah, who knows? Who knows?
Who knows? It's very sad. I wonder how they'll split up the property between them. I
don't all know for where. One and one for all? I don't know.
Well, maybe.
Is that the pirate
code? The thing is, when you get married, you're meant to say, till death us do part. So,
but he was already dead.
Yeah. I don't understand it. I don't think this story's true. Hey, you know, I just don't think it is.
Paul recently caught up with Jem Roberts at the British Library to talk about his book, The Tales of Britain.
So joining me on the Spooktator podcast this episode is dear friend and word creator, Jem Roberts.
Hello, Paul.
So we've asked you to come on the show today because I believe you have something rather delightful that may appeal to our listeners. I don't know why I'm doing it in that voice. I do apologise.
Well, Paul, we have gathered here today at London's famous British Library to celebrate books of all kinds. Mm. And I've got a new book coming out, which... believe it or not, is the first collection of British folktales to be published in over 30 years.
When you were going through this and doing your research, there were some obvious stories that we could go to. Obviously, the Green Man is probably a good one near your neck of the woods. But were there stories there that you found that you were like, how do we not know this story?
Oh, loads. Well, exactly. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, there's the obvious stuff. There's King Arthur, there's Robin Hood, there's Dick Whittington, there's the Three Little Pigs, there's the Three Bears, and not Goldilocks, but that's a whole other story. You'll have to buy the book. there's all that obvious stuff. The Babes in the Wood in Norfolk. But then there is Molly Whoopi as well, who is I don't want to use the term heroine. She's a hero from the Western Isles of Scotland, and she's a wily, brave, clever woman or young girl who fights bogles and giants and has all these adventures. And hardly anyone's heard of them. And one of the things that really exercised me is, I like a Pixar movie as much as the next person, but I paid money to go and see Brave, for instance, in the cinema. Now, everything in that movie, Brave, was invented by a Hollywood scriptwriter in Hollywood. Mm. It had nothing. It was vaguely flavoured with British folklore, okay. but none of it was genuine at all. It was all totally made up in Hollywood. And yet, Molly Whoopi is just there. You know, she should be like, I mean, I've forgotten the list just now, Jack and the Beanstalk, the most obvious one of all. Mm. She's like a female Jack. But that's part of this kind of misogyny, really, that's kind of kept these stories hidden away for so long. And this is the 21st century, and these stories deserve to be known. And at the moment, there's no option. You've got, you know, there's almost nowhere to find these things in a palatable way. And I hope that, you know, I write comedy, I've done lots of things, I write my own children's stories, and I hope I've found a way of taking these crusty old tales and just giving them a brush down and making them suitable in the 21st century. There's so much to Tales of Britain to get across, because not only is it a collection of 77 stories from all over England and Scotland and Wales and Curnow and the Isles, not only is it all that, but also at the end of every story there's a little tourist guide as well.
Oh,
with,
nice.
With URLs and just sort of an idea of what you can actually go and see. So the idea really of the book, even though this is not at all a children's book any more than, you know, Toy Story is a children's film. You know, it's for everyone. It's like you wouldn't call The Simpsons a children's TV show. It's exactly the same thing. I mean, okay. my real inspiration is sort of partly Pixar and The Simpsons and partly Grimm Tales with Rick Mayall.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, so many tangents I could go off, and we've only got so much of your lovely podcast that we can squeeze
in. Oh, we can bump this out. It's all right.
But, I mean, just as a quick aside, I've been working on this for so long that going back to sort of whenever it was, 2012, 2013, top of my list for that year when I'd already written about 40 different stories, and I was trying to get a TV format and all these other things done, top of the list was contact Rick Mayall's people about the TV format for Tales of Britain, because really Grimm Tales is what I'm aiming for. It's that kind of cheek, that kind of, because the beautiful thing about Rick Mayall and Grimm Tales is that it was so anarchic and so funny and so silly, but at the same time he could just turn on a sixpence and become really serious and really heart, you know, really
about managing those tones.
Exactly. So basically I've written the Tales of Britain is written in the guise of Brother Bernard, because it's not about me. This isn't like Neil Gaiman's Norse Tales or Stephen Fry's Greek Tales. I'm Jem Roberts. I write books about
comedy. Are you?
I am indeed, Paul. Nice to meet you.
But the point
is, this is my fifth book. I've written the official book on I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. I wrote the official book on Blackadder. I wrote the official book on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Douglas Adams. And my latest book, Soupy Twist, which is also in shops if you have any shops near you, is the official story of Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. So I write books about comedy and I perform comedy. But what I'm not known for is folklore. And I didn't want this to be Jem Roberts' Tales of Britain, because the point that I keep stressing is, and no one really quite grasps it, is there isn't another collection of British folktales. This is it. It's the only one you're going to get, and so why would I want to limit it by being my take on these things?
Okay.
So it's Brother Bernard, who is this sort of thousands and thousands year old scribe.
Oh, that's right, yeah, yeah.
Who, you know, a secular monk, if you like, who's collected all these stories together like sort of a venerable bead. But I kind of created that character for Rick Mayall, whether it be radio or TV. Mm. And I was, and you know how Rick Mayall's career was towards the end. I thought it would be well up for it. So, but that's the thing. It was on the list, right? Contact Rick Mayall. And then a couple of months later, the sad news came through that he's no longer around. Mm. So the other thing about this book is it's partly in tribute to Rick, but also I went out for dinner with the wonderful Terry Jones, who's also a teller of fairy tales, one of the most wonderful storytellers of my childhood, and a very, very friendly and lovely man who I knew from my previous books. I'd interviewed him for the Blackadder book, and I have interviewed him on stage as well. I think I might have actually been the last person ever to interview Terry Jones.
Oh, of course.
Not that I want to be a Jonah, you know, but it's true. And so
I put that on the CV.
I thought the fact that this is the first collection of British folktales in generations to be released, I thought he would be well up for basically joining me, because I didn't want to make it about me. I contacted J.K. Rowling and David Walliams. The idea being that anyone can join in and pitch in and reinvent these stories, and we'll just bring them up under one umbrella. And he loved the idea, and he offered to write a foreword for it. And I went out to dinner with him and his partner and their little 5-year-old girl back in when it was 2013 or something. And obviously the sad news came out about his illness, so there's no way I was going to ask him, chase him up for that forward.
Yeah.
So now Tales of Britain is coming out as a special in tribute to Terry Jones, so it's in tribute to him at the start.
So what I'll say is this, I'll ask you this. When you were researching the book, did you find anything about Britain as a result? Did you discover anything new? Because, like, for instance, from our point of view, and from when I was doing ghost hunting for all those bloody years, I found out that even though, as I've stated, I don't believe in ghosts, but I found that visiting these places were a good document of the history, so the ghost stories became part of history. Do you find that the folk tales reflected that in the same way? There was that kernel of truth to them.
Well, history is absolutely crucial. I'm glad you asked that, because there are lots of many ways. There are 77 stories all over the place, and I was trying to make it so that everyone in the country would have a story within, you know, a decent drive away or for a Sunday afternoon. The idea being, you could tell the story to your kids. As I repeat, it's not a kid's book, but you could do it as a bedtime story on a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And then on Sunday afternoon, get in the car and you all go off and go to the real place. And for me, I just think, as a kid, I'd love that, to be standing there and think, that's where the giant was, that's where the dragon curled its way around the hill and everything. That's really what I'm aiming for. But that I could have presented them in so many different ways. But historically is the way I've done it. So the very first of the 77 stories is Prince Brutus from the Battle of Troy, who was the founder of Britain, who landed in Totnes and was the founder of London, which was New Troy, Trinovantium, which became Londinium, which became London. Yeah. So that's the very first, and it goes all through history. So, for instance, obviously you have King Arthur sort of in the middle of the first millennium, and then you have Robin Hood arguably in the time of King John or Edward II. There's a whole argument there.
Depending
about
on your film adaptation.
Exactly. All the way up to like Loch Ness Monster, which was 1913.
I was going to say, what's the most recent one you've got there?
Loch Ness Monster, really? Yeah, exactly.
Is it, yeah, could you write that 60s, 70s?
I mean, there is an old legend about St. Cuthbert and Loch Ness, but I refer to that, but that's a little bit dodgy, to be honest. So it's the 1930s that was invented. And so that's basically the whole, and it does, it shows a whole different sweep of the history of Britain. And here, this is the crucial thing, and it kind of refers back to the tangent that I lost earlier, which is talking about making these stories suitable without whitewashing. It's not about reworking, making them politically correct, or whitewashing them.
Because context is important as well.
Well, you cannot tell most of these stories. Going back to what I was saying about my friend and him having these two daughters, I promised, I looked at where they were in Cheshire, and I said, oh God, he's got these two daughters, I've promised to do the story. Looked at my stories, looked at the map, and oh, in the Lake District, Long Meg and her daughters. And so I promised my oldest friend there and then, for his unborn daughters, I was going to adapt the story of Long Meg and her daughters, which is a standing stone, which is there in the Lake District. And I went home, and I looked up the source material, and basically the story basically came down to, thou shalt not dance on the Lord's Day. And it's about these women that dared to dance beyond midnight on a Saturday.
Wow.
And so God turned them all to stone. And I thought, well, what a wonderful message that is to give to girls in the 21st century.
Yeah.
And not that I wish to pat myself on the back too much, but I'm really proud of what I did, which is just the tiniest little flick of a philtrum, not philtrum, never mind, but just a little flick of a spigot in that story. Yeah. Without rewriting it, without whitewashing it, all I did is, instead, there's like this sort of clergyman who came along and said, thou shalt not dance on his Lord's Day. Instead of him being sort of the victor and God striking these women down, it's Long Meg's decision to turn to stone to escape the persecution from the Christians who've come along, this new religion who are saying, thou shalt not do this, even though they've been dancing on Sunday since time immemorial. So they escape persecution by turning themselves into stone. They are in control, and they are, you know, when you're not looking at those stones, they are still dancing women, and one day they shall be free forever to dance however they like. Mm. So it becomes generally about female emancipation. And that also ties into what we were saying about history, in that, you know, people say, well, it's a, you know, I came across this when I wrote the official Blackadder book, The True History of the Blackadder. You know, I'm very proud to be British. That doesn't mean that I think being British means I'm better than, British is better than anyone else. It's not about nationalism. You can be proud to be British. You can be patriotic without being nationalistic or thinking you're better than anyone else. But the fact is that no one celebrated British folklore at all. It is time to take a stand for these things. But people go, oh, it's a little bit, you know, really? You know, what is this about white power or something? But no, because the whole point is, being British means being an immigrant. We all came to this island at some point.
Well, most of the stories, I'd imagine, are based from the history of invasions and conquering and things like that. Anyway,
that's where they all come from. And there's a whole introduction by Brother Bernard which makes this absolutely explicit, that we start with, you know, there was a point 8,000 years ago where this was part of, you know, Doggerland that got flooded and suddenly we were an island. And there may have been a few, you know, troglodytic type kind of people here on this scrag of land at that time. But since then, everyone that's come along, be they the Beaker people, whole waves of different Celts, and then obviously you've got the... I mean, this is the thing. You know, King Arthur only exists as a figure that was fighting against the English who came and invaded. Mm. So you've got the English who came in and took over, and then you've got the Normans, and then you've got Huguenots, and you've got everything, including Windrush generations, and still people coming to this country for asylum now. Mm. And they all bring with them their own stories, and they create their own stories here. And that's what we've been doing. And that's where these 77 tales come from. They are stories that have been created by different waves of immigrants coming to this island for thousands of years and just entertaining each other around the fire. And to fit in with the podcast theme, there are some ghost stories involved. Good. There are some, but the other thing is there aren't too many. Because the other thing is, people still saying, this can't be right. This can't be right that this is the first collection in over 30 years. Mm. But it really is, because, as I say, there's all these little localised versions. But what there also is, there've been loads and loads and loads and loads and bloody loads of books of British folklore. Mm. Like you say, The Green Man. There isn't a story of The Green Man. It's not in the book because it's not a story. It's lore.
Yeah.
It's not a tale with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so, I love ghost stories and I love folklore. And this is the thing. I've got a lot of these books. But you try looking for a really good story amongst these things. Mm. And it's just, there's at least 20 ghost stories for every proper legend.
Okay.
And I wanted to bring together the stories that stand alone, you know. And ghost stories are a very separate thing, I think.
No, they are. The more, I don't know, what's the name? There are more emotional tales than
they
are, kind of like.
I mean, there are still some. There's the Kintraw Doonies up in Scotland, for instance, who are these fairies that either appear as old people or as sort of ghostly little ponies in the hills that will sort of, you know, drag people away and take them under the hills and everything. And there's a mother of some children who doesn't get back in time, and she becomes, oh my gosh, I wish I'd done my research before talking to you about this. Mm. I think it's Cooniag, which is like a Scottish banshee.
Yeah.
So she becomes this sort of lost soul, this ghost that kind of looks over her children but can't contact them. So that's technically a ghost story. But this is quite, a dodgy thing to say on a podcast which is, you know, mainly about ghosts. But I've really tried to clear out all the ghost stories and keep them as a separate
thing. No, but
I think
that makes sense.
Just because there's so many and I wanted to kind of let the different stories stand on their own. But there's nothing else like it. This is the thing. This is why it's called Tales of Britain. It's not called this, that, and the other. And it's funny, even now there are still people bringing out collections of... I just saw the other day somebody brought out a collection of horse-themed folk tales and and plant-themed folk tales.
Right.
And they're theming these things to within an inch of their lives. And I just feel like standing up and saying, do you realise there is literally not a collection of British folk tales? And there hasn't been since the 80s, and you haven't been able to buy one. And now, as of the 17th of January, finally, there is one. And it's called Tales of Britain. And it's 11 quid.
Hooray! And you can get it on Kindle and Amazon and all that stuff as well, I'd imagine.
You can. It's a lot cheaper. That way.
So what's the quickest route to get a book? Can we go to your website? Can we just go to Amazon?
Yes, indeed. Thank you. There is talesofbritain.com, which will click all the way through to what you need to get. And you can get, you know, it's lovely to have the electronic version, which has got like little, because all the tourist guides have URLs to the different tourist guides around the country and everything. Yeah. So it's, you know, hopefully tourists will be glad to have it as well. But I'm really hoping to actually sell the book as well. The dream is that people can have a copy of this in the back seat of the car with the tartan blanket and the travel suites and start
on
to explore.
On a coffee table, maybe?
Well, maybe that, but I just like the idea. I mean, I would do it myself if I had the money and the time. But the idea of exploring Britain through its stories, because there's stories all over the place and people don't know. I mean, The local people might know. This is the thing. If wherever you were born and brought up, you might know your local folk tales that your nan might have told you. But there might be a story up in Inverness which somebody from Brighton would love, and vice versa. So that's really what it's about. It's about just sort of bringing all these together for the first time in decades and celebrating them on behalf of everyone, no matter what their gender or wherever they originate from in their view. We are all British on this island, no matter where we've come from. And this is for us standing together and celebrating our stories together.
Beautiful. Jem Roberts, thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
And back to the studio.
Thank you, Paul. There you go. Lovely interview with my mate Jem about his book.
Excellent. Well, this has been another episode of the Spooktator podcast. You can find links to everything we have discussed at our website, spooktator.co.uk, where you can also find ways of subscribing to the show, leaving reviews and getting in touch with us, including links to all of our social media accounts. We've only got two. I don't know why I said all. It's just two.
Two is all, though.
Yeah.
So it's fine.
We would really love it if you could take a few seconds to leave a positive review for the podcast on whichever app or service you use to listen to us. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, remember, spooky is in the eye of the beholder.